Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I want to start with a thank you to the InTown Club. The club invited me to come over and speak at the Union Club to them yesterday about how we're making journalism sustainable in Cleveland. It was a good news message, and they pretended to be very receptive to what was probably a very boring speech. Thanks very much. It's Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn, here with people who are never boring, Layla Tassi and Lisa Garvin. Mara Johnston's on jury duty, so we may get some interesting stories from her when she gets back. Let's begin. Can you say audacious? What's the latest move by disgraced former House Speaker Larry Householder to stack the deck in his favor in his bribery trial scheduled for early next year? Layla, this pushes the bounds of audacity.
Yeah, but what are you going to do if you're an attorney for Larry Householder? Right? This is them doing their job, I guess. But his attorneys are basically asking the court to bar a whole bunch of evidence from trial. First, he doesn't want the jury to hear about an admission from First Energy that the company paid a $4.3 million bribe to Sam Randazzo, the former PUCO chair, who's not been charged with a crime in this case, and he denies wrongdoing. But Householder argues that whether or not First Energy bribed Randazzo is irrelevant to Householder's case because it doesn't make it more or less likely that Householder's guilty of the charge that he faces. he also wants the court to exclude several statements from Neil Clark, who was a powerful GOP lobbyist who was charged alongside Householder. Unfortunately, you know, Clark took his own life last year. But the statements were in secretly recorded phone calls from the FBI. Clark had said in those conversations that the nonprofit used to collect money from First Energy was, quote, the speakers. He also said that Householder would, quote, go to the wall, but that he could only do it once a year because then everyone would know he's pay to play. And he also made a comment about how First Energy would be getting $1.3 billion in subsidies, free payments. So why would they care about putting in a measly $20 million into the dark money nonprofit? So Householder's lawyer said Clark's statements are irrelevant. You know, everything's irrelevant, right? Because Householder never participated in those conversations. He never accepted a check. And he, you know, quote, took no action, official or otherwise, with respect to any sports betting legislation, which was the false premise of the FBI officials who were approaching Clark at the time, pretending to be political donors. And then finally, you know, Householder asked the court to exclude from evidence First Energy's deferred prosecution agreement, in which they copped to bribing Randazzo. Householder argues that letting the jury hear about that agreement would be to allow a series of statements accusing him of misconduct with no ability to confront his accuser.
This is
so
crazy.
That's all,
man.
The spaghetti at the wall.
It's just crazy. It's saying, hey, look, I want to exclude all the evidence that incriminates me because it incriminates me. I mean, First Energy was the funder of a massive bribery scheme and has admitted bribing people. And so say that that's not applicable to the charge that they bribed him is preposterous. Wouldn't it be great if for murder defendants to be able to get away with this? Yeah. I don't want the gun. I don't want the surveillance video of me shooting the guy used because that's really incriminating evidence. And I don't think it's fair. It's just that it's like the audacity.
Well, sometimes they try that, you know. Lawyers got to try. That's the point.
The much smarter play for him, even though he continues to protest his innocence in the face of a tidal wave of evidence, would have been to cut a deal. I mean, this is talk about audacity. I will be shocked if the judge does this. Maybe what they were really doing, you said throw the spaghetti on the wall. Maybe by throwing that much spaghetti on the wall, they're hoping for a couple of pieces to stick. You know, if we challenge everything, the judge can't possibly say no to everything, so we can get rid of a couple of things. But
that's a sound you know, approach. I'm sure that's what they're trying here. Of course.
Yeah, it's a hopeless situation for that guy. It's Today in Ohio. Do we have an inkling now of why the woman who was nominated and confirmed to be the U.S. attorney for the Northern Ohio District walked away before even starting the job? Lisa, this came from an AP story that was pretty surprising.
Apparently, former Cleveland Assistant U.S. Attorney Marissa Darden was partying with the wrong people in Columbia. She was named back in November of last year by Sherrod Brown to be the next, you know, U.S. attorney in Northern Ohio. She would have been the first Black woman to hold that job. The Senate confirmed her in April, but then she backed out about 3 weeks later. So the Associated Press did a series of stories on corrupt DEA agents, and they had an interview with convicted DEA agent Jose Irizarry before going to federal prison on money laundering charges. So he says that Marissa Darden attended a 2017 party at his Columbia coastal home, where two DEA agents did ecstasy at this party, although Irizarry said that he did not see Darden do drugs or see her observing others doing drugs. And Darden's attorney, James Woolley, who's a former AUSA himself, said that she has cooperated and answered questions, you know, for confirmation, for her confirmation and her background check from the FBI, and she answered questions in the probe of corrupt federal agents. There's no evidence that she participated, says Woolley. So this might be guilt by association. But Irizarry named two other federal prosecutors from Miami who attended his parties, and they denied wrongdoing in that case. So why? And apparently he had these parties. He has a really nice $760,000 home on the coast of Columbia with a rooftop pool. He held a lot of parties, and apparently a lot of DEA and FBI agents showed up to these parties. So, yeah.
I think this is sad if this is the reason she dropped out, because it doesn't sound like there's any evidence that she did anything wrong. She just, like you said, partied with the wrong guy. And if Jim Woolley, who we know to be a very upstanding guy, he doesn't lie. We've never seen a case where he lies. If he's telling us that she cooperated, there's nothing to incriminate her. I would hate to think this is why she walked away, because all signs were she would have been a great U.S. attorney.
Right. And, you know, when I read this story, too, I'm like, so where's the fire? But then again, she's a Black woman. She's a Democrat. They probably would have tried to drag her through the, even though she was, you know, she got the confirmation. You know, when this came out, I imagine that it could have been ugly.
It's sad.
No matter what happened.
Yeah, I just think it's sad because I think we were all pretty excited she got the job because it seemed like she was going to be a great figure. And if they're not saying this is the reason. She said, I'm leaving for my family. And maybe that's true. And this had nothing to do with it. It's just coincidental. But it would be a shame if this is the reason. It's today in Ohio. Is Cleveland in danger of losing one of its campiest yet most beloved tourist attractions, the Christmas Story House? And I think I'm the only one on the podcast today who's actually been through that house. But Layla, what's the story?
Nice. The Christmas Story House is for sale. Can you believe it? That's crazy. This house was built in 1895, and of course it was used in the filming of A Christmas Story in 1983. And owner Brian Jones, who bought the house on eBay in 2004 and turned it into this popular attraction that it is today, has decided it's time to move on to other things. So commercial real estate firm Hoff and Lee of Fairlawn have listed this property. It's being jointly marketed nationally and globally by REAG, which is a merger and acquisitions firm in Cleveland and Pittsburgh. And the sale includes the house, the nearby museum, and a gift shop, and the adjacent Bumpus house, you know, the Bumpuses. Oh, the Bumpuses.
Yeah, with their dogs.
and their dogs, right. And then four additional properties. So it's kind of like a whole campus. And, you know, the museum features an extensive collection of original costumes and props, behind the scenes photos and other stuff like that. And, you know, there's a 4,000 square foot gift shop. There's this detached garage that has a 1939 Ford LaFrance fire truck, like the one featured in the film. That's included in this sale. So this place is ranked fourth on TripAdvisor's top attractions in Cleveland. It stays open year-round, 7 days a week to tourists. It's going to stay open while they're selling it. Reporter Paris Wolf tells us that this is my favorite part of the story, that serious prospectors here who inquire about the property are asked to respond by telling the real estate firm about the following: yourself and your background, your finances, income, and things like that, source of funds for the purchase, and a theme. What I want to buy a Christmas story house, why I want to buy a Christmas story house and museum. So, you know, I hope they find a buyer who'll do right by this little Cleveland gem.
It was a labor of love. When he first bought it by eBay, you know, he made a bid on eBay and came and started putting this together. Everybody thought, what is he doing? And he's turned it into a delightful way to spend a couple of hours. It really is worth going through. I saw the movie when it was originally in theaters. It dates me a good bit. And they really capture the spirit of it. It's a great little place to go. And what is this, 75,000 people a year visited. I hope whoever buys it keeps it going as a tourist attraction and doesn't somehow privatize it.
Does it really take 2 hours? Like, can you actually spend 2 hours
there? Well, in the house itself, because there's other people walking around and you go upstairs and, you know, there's the phone. You pick up the phone and you can hear that rat screaming. It's like, and then there's, they have the museum, and I don't know, maybe it's a little less than 2 hours, but it's not something you do in 5 minutes. There's stuff to see, stuff to walk around and look at. It's a delightful stop. To take people to if you have visitors from out of town. And I hope it continues. This guy had a great vision, and he's kept it going now for nearly two decades. And I remember when he first started, a lot of people thought, is that really going to work as an attraction?
Yeah.
It really does.
I frankly didn't know that there was so much to it until I read this story. I was like, oh, it's a big, you know, sprawling kind of place. You can, you know, I didn't know about the, you know, the gift shop that was so big. And That's cool. I think we might actually swing by this season.
Well, and you look out back and there's the fence where the guys in the striped shirts were coming across, and he's, you know, shooting his Red Ryder BB rifle at it. And it has the leg lamp in the window, and they sell all shapes and sizes of leg lamps in the gift shop. I know that's what you want for the decor in your renovated house.
Seasonal.
We'll have to keep up with who buys it. I would love to get the themes. Even if you run them anonymously, it would be fun to publish the themes. It's Today in Ohio. With Republicans decisively running the table in the election last week in Ohio, and Sherrod Brown, a Democrat, up for re-election in 2 years, what do the Democrats have to do to get Brown re-elected, Lisa?
Well, they're going to have to do a whole lot of work. And, you know, the fact that Tim Ryan, despite outspending J.D. Vance in the U.S. Senate race, still lost by a good margin, they think that signals trouble for Sherrod Brown's reelection in 2024. And the Republicans are already lining up to take him on. The outgoing GOP party chair for Ohio, Bob Poduchik, says Brown is in real trouble. He said that to an Ohio Chamber of Commerce conference earlier. He said that Brown is working class Democrat, and there aren't many left in Ohio. They're all working class conservatives now. So the University of Akron poli sci professor David Cohen says that 2024 will be more difficult than 2018 because 2018 was not a presidential election year, and there was a Democratic wave and Democratic enthusiasm in 2018, and he was running against a weak candidate, Jim Renacci. So the Dems are scratching their heads. What happened? They're saying that the biggest thing is the lack of national investment in the Ryan campaign, and also in the Democratic Ohio Supreme Court races too. You know, we have two of the three Democrats on the Ohio Supreme Court, Michael Donnelly and Melody Stewart, will be up for election in 2024. So they'll be on the ballot, and they'll need effective Democratic campaigning to win those seats. And they did point out that there was national money dumped into some Ohio congressional races that helped people win in Toledo, Akron, and Cincinnati. So as for those people possibly, you know, chomping at the bit for Brown's seat, we're looking at Frank LaRose, our Secretary of State, Congressman Matt Dolan, Attorney General David Yost, and also the ever popular Bernie Moreno.
I do wonder, I agree with what everybody's saying, that this makes it a bigger challenge for Sherrod Brown. What happened last week clearly is a sign. But I also know that Sherrod Brown won Ohio by 7 points, while Trump was winning by 8. So he's gotten people to split the ticket. The other thing about Sherrod Brown he is authentic. People know him. He stands for something. He's always stood for it. And he has been reliable. When he goes around and talks about his record, it's not what he's going to do. It's what he's done. And he's delivered for Ohio. I just wonder whether all of the years of incumbency make him a tough beat. I don't see Bernie Moreno being able to beat Sherrod Brown anyway, no way, no how. And I don't know that Frank LaRose has that kind of juice either, because he's been kind of a percentage-wise election denier. Not saying that Biden wasn't elected, but there were anomalies. And, you know, he's played that silly game, and Sherrod could point that out. Clearly, that's not a smart strategy these days. I think the sheer force of his personality could brush back many comers, but he can't take it for granted.
Right. So we'll have to see what happens. I mean, he's well loved, although we did see, you know, a red wave in Ohio. We're no longer a swing state. That's pretty obvious. So maybe that's why Republicans here see an opening.
Well, he'll also have 2 years of experience if J.D. Vance is a senator, and he could say, see, this is what you get. It's today in Ohio. Ohio police departments have received $70 million in stimulus cash aimed at reducing violent crime. Layla, we did a big look. How are they spending it?
These grants are part of the Ohio Violent Crime Reduction Grant Program that's being funded by American Rescue Plan Act dollars from the state. And Lucas DiPrilli, our Stimulus Watch reporter, took a look at how the money's being distributed to law enforcement agencies. And what really jumped out at him was that the preponderance of it is being spent on either hiring new police officers or paying officers retention bonuses to keep them from leaving. So far, there have been 164 grants distributed to 146 law enforcement agencies. Some of it will pay for, you know, tech and surveillance and implementing new strategies, but really the lion's share goes to personnel, retention bonuses, hiring bonuses, OT, and hiring more employees. Some agencies are even exclusively using their money for retention bonuses. And here's one example of what that looks like. In the city of Bucyrus, they got a $446,000 grant to add two patrol officers for 2 years and then pay retention bonuses. Their plan is to continue paying for these positions after the grant expires through a change in the city's tax credit for residents who work out of town. In their grant application, they describe this domino effect that began when, quote, almost every employee at the department got COVID and the academy saw fewer trainees during the pandemic. On account of that, existing officers felt overworked. They started looking for jobs elsewhere. That made it even harder to hire or retain officers. So they hope that this money will kind of stop that bleeding. They can't afford to offer permanent raises, but they're handing out these retention bonuses that are $3,500 for dispatchers and $4,500 for each of 20 officers. So it's kind of a microcosm of what a lot of departments are dealing with right now.
Look, I get it. And it's one-time money and you can transform. Right. And if you're going to attack violent crime, you want to use novel methods, but you can't do it unless you have police officers. So you kind of understand why they're using the money this way. You want to fight violent crime, you have to have police to start with.
You know what, though? The issue here is that, in Bucyrus's case, they claim to have this plan to sustain this bigger workforce. But this is one-time money, so you have to have that sustainability piece or you end up having to lay off officers when that money runs out. So,
the job market tightens up and police are leaving less often. I mean, during the past couple of years, there's been so much job mobility. Everybody's been trying to keep hold of workers, but the economy is moving. And so it's possible it won't be as hard to maintain police.
But interestingly, Lucas points out that the majority of people who are leaving the force are because of retirement. So that kind of attrition needs backfill. And, you have to be able to sustain the workforce. Overall, how do we feel about retention bonuses? I'd like to know a little bit more about that, I guess.
Well, I'm sure you would like to have one.
I mean, if you take one of these bonuses, do you pledge to stay with the department for a certain number of years? Do you have to pay it back if you back out of that? I mean, what's the long-term benefit of that approach? Or are we giving bonuses to folks who were planning on staying there for their entire career anyway?
I would hope that you'd get some kind of commitment that they'd stay. It has been hard. It's been hard to find officers because of the retirements. Cleveland would love to hire more qualified officers to get them in. They can't hire people fast enough. And so these other departments are trying to hold on. I have a hard time criticizing the use of the money for this, because if you take out the police officers, if you have a reduced number, it puts pressure on the ones that are there. They start to get reckless. We saw that after Jane Campbell laid off all those police officers in Cleveland. That started their descent into ugly uses of force and bad decision making that was only corrected with a federal investigation and a consent decree.
Yeah.
It's Today in Ohio. How are Cuyahoga County and other large counties in Ohio defying a nationwide increase in birth rates? Lisa, it's a little bit alarming to see the difference in the big cities.
Yeah, isn't this interesting? The Center for Disease Control had preliminary data that shows that the birth rate in 2021, both nationally and in Ohio, was 1%. This is turning around birth rate declines that have been going on since 2014. And the birth rate increased 10% in 9 Ohio rural counties, including Vinton County, 26% increased birth rate, and Meigs County. They're both in southern Ohio. Meigs had a 24% increase. But if you look at urban areas, Franklin, Cuyahoga, and Camilton counties, according to Ohio Department of Health data, saw decreases in the birth rate of up to 1%. And so, but if you look at the counties that surround Cuyahoga County, the rate is much higher in all of the counties except for Summit that surround Cuyahoga County. So when they dug into the data a little bit, they found that in Cuyahoga, white births went up by almost 3% last year. Black births went down 3.8%. And that's despite Cuyahoga having the largest black population in Ohio. So Wendy Manning, who's a sociology professor at Bowling Green State University, said the trends are kind of mixed. She said back in 2005, the rate in Ohio was 63.5 births per 1,000 women. That put us at number 34 nationally. But in 2020, we had a lower birth rate, 60 per 1,000, but that raised us up to 21. So, you know, birth rates are, it's kind of a mixed trend. But, she says that, why did this happen? She thinks that pandemic family planning was delayed during 2020, so it pushed births off to 2021. Ohio's aging population, she thinks, is a big factor. And then the people, women of childbearing, age are leaving the state. The average age of a woman who gives birth is 29.1 years in Cuyahoga County. So they say they're moving out of state or moving to the suburbs where the birth rate went up.
You know, we just coincidentally are talking about this on the morning that it was reported that the world population has hit 8 billion, and it was about 3 billion when I was born. So that's a staggering increase in the number of humans walking around this planet. I'm not sure why it's viewed as good news that the birth rate has gone up in most of Ohio and the United States.
Right. I mean, we're short houses as it is, So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
8 billion people. It's Today in Ohio. A former Bowling Green State University student who was suspended for 8 years involving a 2021 hazing death is now suing the school. Layla, what is his case?
Well, this stems from the death of Stone Foltz, a student at Bowling Green University who died of alcohol poisoning after attending an off-campus party hosted by the Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity. And the plaintiff in this suit against the school is Chase Weiss of Beechwood. Last July, a committee convened by the university suspended Weiss for 8 years, as you said, for his involvement in the events that led to Foltz's death. And they ruled that the suspension goes in his permanent academic file, and they also prohibited Weiss from ever setting foot on campus again. And Weiss is suing the campus and arguing that they violated his right to due process by preventing him from cross-examining witnesses. He's also claiming that the suspension unconstitutionally hampers his ability to pursue an education elsewhere. And the judge has since dismissed the accusations against everyone but one university administrator, the Dean of Students, Christopher Bullins. He also limited the lawsuit's scope to the denial of Weiss's right to cross-examine his accuser or witness in the disciplinary hearing. But until this week, Weiss was trying to avoid divulging his identity, and he was going as John Doe on the lawsuit, which really irked the judge, and the judge threatened to dismiss the case outright if Weiss didn't identify himself in the case. So that has changed, and now we know his identity.
So does it look like he has a pretty good case?
I don't know. It's been a while since I dusted off my law degree. I'm not sure if I could pontificate on that. What's your thoughts?
It seems like that it was a pretty draconian punishment, and if they can't really prove that he had an involvement, that maybe he has the case. We'll have to see how that civil case proceeds. Mm-hmm. It's today in Ohio. Leaf collection is in full running right now. It's running outside my window. It appears that the leaves have mostly fallen in most of our neighborhoods. What happens to all those leaves, Lisa? Tell me they're not going to landfills.
Well, so funny that this happened. I don't know if you can hear the leaf blowers outside my window, but my landscaper showed up and started blowing leaves off of my bed in the back where I wanted to leave them. So I had to leave the podcast and run out and say, stop, put the leaves back, leave them there. So anyway, it depends on the community. So, you know, we talked to people in Shaker Heights and Rocky River, and those two cities take their leaves to composting facilities. It costs them about $7.50 a ton to get this recycled into things like leaf humus and compost and other products. Brecksville, they have a residential garbage service pickup, and so that's stuff goes to the landfill. I know here in Lyndhurst, you know, they say that they recycle and compost the leaves that they gather. I have no reason to doubt them. I don't know if they use an extra, an outside company or do it themselves. But there are two big composters. There's Kurtz Brothers in Avon and Boyas Excavating in Valley View. And they do take some of these leaves from cities. They make enriched topsoil, humus, and mulch with it. But then again, we talked to the Ohio Department of Natural Resources forester, David Parrott. And, you know, because people say, you know, should I leave my leaves all winter? Should I rake them? And he says it's fine to leave them over the winter. You know, they provide fertilizer as they break down and decompose. They, you know, provide cover for wildlife and insects and that kind of thing. So he says, you know, you should probably just run your lawnmower over the leaves to mulch them into the lawn. He says it's a heck of a lot better than bagging them, because if you bag them, they're going to go to the landfill.
Yeah, the idea that we would send leaves to the landfill makes no sense whatsoever. It's so easy to convert them into mulch, and they're good for the environment. It's a good use of them, and it just seems like a lazy out. Yeah, we're not going to bother taking them to get shredded. We'll just take them to the landfill and make it part of our dumping fee. Dumb.
Right, right. And some cities apparently require you to put them in, you know, because here we just rake them to the curb. And I think most cities are like that. But some require you to put them into like leaf bags. And you know that stuff's going to a landfill. So, you know, with all the, you know, and this is such a good resource for Northeast Ohio. Look at how many leaves we have. I mean, to think that a lot of it's not getting recycled is kind of concerning.
The part of the story that makes no sense to me in a neighborhood like mine with gazillions of trees, they said, yeah, just mow it. It'll break up and fall into your lawn. We have so many leaves fall. There's no way you could do that. Your entire lawn would be covered, and your grass would all die. I was a little bit surprised that seemed to be an answer. Maybe if you have a small tree, it works. It's today in Ohio. What is stage zero breast cancer, and how is a new test available at the Cleveland Clinic helping some women who have it avoid prophylactic radiation treatments? Layla?
Well, reporter Gretchen Kuda-Crowan tells us that with more women seeking breast cancer screenings, we're seeing more women also being diagnosed with a very early form of breast cancer called ductal carcinoma in situ. And this is considered a non-invasive precancer, which is why doctors sometimes refer to it as stage zero breast cancer. It's not life-threatening. Having it simply means that you have abnormal cells in the lining of the milk ducts in the breast. But the problem here is that although virtually all invasive cancer begins as this, DCIS, not all DCIS will go on to become an invasive cancer. And, you know, that could spread throughout your body and kill you. And until recently, doctors and patients had no way to figure out the difference between these. And because of that, doctors would frequently advise their patients to submit to all kinds of aggressive treatments like radiation or even a mastectomy just to be on the safe side. And now they have this test called DCI-SIUN-RT. I think that's how you break it down. Using a sample of the abnormal brain tissue or breast tissue, it looks at 7 unique protein signals associated with the growth and development of cancerous cells. The test uses these biomarkers plus information about the age of the patient and whether you could feel the tumor size, and if it was fully removed during surgery to generate a risk score from 1 to 10. And that number can be used to predict who would benefit from radiation and who won't. In testing out this diagnostic tool, it turned out that only about 1% of patients who decided to forego radiation on account of using the tool to help them decide could have actually benefited from the radiation. So 99% of people who use it are, you know, in the clear and don't need to go through all of that. So it's really helping women make informed decisions about which course of action to take when they're faced with this super scary diagnosis.
Yeah, I was talking to Laura about this story yesterday because she had noted that we hadn't talked about it yet. And she felt very strongly that this is quite important because I guess she's mm-hmm. known people who this could affect. And when you have this blanket treatment that actually endangers people, I mean, radiation is not a good thing for you if you don't need it to stave off breast cancer. She felt strongly that we should talk about this as much as possible. She wanted to be here to do so.
Well, it would also keep women, because a lot of women, especially women who have a gene for cancer, you know, are getting prophylactic mastectomies too, because they're afraid of getting cancer. So,
right.
It's a good story. Check it out. It's on cleveland.com. It's Today in Ohio, and we're done for a Tuesday. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Lisa. I don't think Laura will be here tomorrow, but she should be back on Thursday.